Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
I sometimes think these sports people and teams we all follow have the easiest part of the whole gig. All they have to do is execute their skills under the most intense pressure imaginable with the world watching. The rest of us have to just sit there and do just that, just watch and go through the absolute ringer while we're doing it. And yesterday was an absolute head melter. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Podcast, a place for you to come and decompress while also getting a little bit riled up all over again. Hi Murph, hi Ken.
Hey there.
How are you?
There was a lot going on this Sunday just past, a lot of it all at the same time. I made an early call. I just had to sacrifice something.
Okay.
And my original call was that the Cricket World Cup final had to go.
Okay.
Just couldn't, there was hurt. There was
the, No.
The you Wimbledon, don't need to explain there yourself. There was the hurling, there was the football.
You don't need to explain yourself on.
But it was impossible to continue to ignore it the more and more dramatic it got.
Well, it kept going until 7:45 as well, which was helpful.
Yeah, that's true. The tennis was still going. Anyway, it ended up being the final double screening was tennis and the cricket. I really started focusing in just as this happened.
It's still on for both here. Goes again. Can he give the strike away? This is a big moment. They've got to run. They go to the other end. Oh, he gets in the way. This has got to go all the way to the boundary off the bat. Can you believe this? It has. I do not believe what I've just seen.
Brilliant commentary there by Ian Smith. As a kid, I watched a lot of Test cricket, Murph, but I admit it has gone a little bit by the wayside in recent times. And you have gotten into cricket in quite a big way in recent years.
Well,
so I'm going to ask you, as a cricket expert,
yeah,
three questions.
Okay.
Why was Ben Stokes awarded 6 runs for that? How is it that England won when they actually drew?
Yeah.
And what the hell is a super over?
Okay, so I'll take the first one first, which was, why was Ben Stokes awarded 6 runs for
and
that?
And what he did there, just to be clear, he's hit a shot. He's then running, himself and the other batsmen are running between wickets trying to clock up as many runs as they can.
Trying to get back for 2 runs.
As he's trying to get back for the second run, he's sliding with his bat, just trying to get into...
The fielder throws towards the stumps and
hits his bat, flies off for 4 more runs, essentially.
So basically, Ben Stokes didn't get 6 runs there. Ben Stokes got 2 runs, and there were 4 byes given.
Yeah.
Now, I had to wait until the umpire signaled it before I was sure how many runs that we're actually talking about here. But it should only have been 5 runs, by all accounts. Simon Taufel, who is a former ICC referee or umpire rather, said it should have been 5 runs because basically they could only have given the 4 byes if Ben Stokes had gotten back and made his ground, like got back to the stumps, so that the second runs, those 2 runs had been counted. He still hadn't gotten back, so it should have been 1 run, the 1 run that he and whoever else was at the crease at that time had run.
Should have been 1 plus 4, not 2 plus 4.
Exactly. So it should have been 5. Should have so been it 1 run been for six. Stokes and 4 and 4 byes. Well,
but now I feel like it wasn't a stupid question yesterday.
But again, why is that loud? Like what if, I mean, what's the difference conceptually between just standing there and like hitting the ball away when they throw it back at the wicket and going and making
no, if it's deliberate, you're not given the byes.
Yeah. Oh, and we're supposed to believe it's not deliberate.
That's the story that England are trying to peddle, yes.
So, accidentally...
He was diving full length, like, to make his ground, and it hit off the top of his...
I see where Ken is going here. Ben Stokes was very impressive. We all saw that yesterday. Many, many people don't watch cricket, don't even know who Ben Stokes is. A guy playing at the very top of his game in the biggest match of his life. He knows what he's doing, surely.
Well, I just don't understand how it can be given as points to him. Like, I mean, points, runs, whatever. If like, how can he score points for this? Like, if it's, I mean, I suppose otherwise they could potentially.
Ken, I'm going to blow your mind here.
Yeah.
You also score a point, in your words, as was actually scored in the super over, missing the ball entirely. You can score a point if the bowler bowls it too far wide of the wicket, for example.
No, that's...
You're okay with that?
That's fair enough.
I mean, don't know why I'm using your language of points now, but...
Well, that's a more common situation.
Yeah, and you throw a wide so that the guy can't hit it, so it's right that you'd be punished for that inaccuracy.
But I don't see why you should be allowed to strike the ball twice with your bat in one, in like the one action. It just doesn't make any sense that you should be allowed to do that.
How is it that England won when they actually drew? And it turns out they actually lost because they should have only been given 5 runs.
Yeah. Well, that's the one I'd be focusing on if I was New Zealand, because the rules of the competition state, for better or worse, if you're still level at the end of the super over, that whoever has hit the most boundaries, most 4s and 6s, in the course of the regular innings, so the 250 overs that the two teams have batted, whichever team has hit the most boundaries wins the game. So
why couldn't they just do another super over? Like, everyone was having fun.
What was so super about the over also? I was expecting more. I got to be honest. There was a lot of drama. This is edge of the seat. It was incredible stuff.
You were expecting more
drama.
Well,
it's called a super over. It's just not. It was just an extra over. I thought you'd have to... Every player has to play with their weak hand or no bats.
It's not like...
It's not like the World Chess Championship.
Over.
Yeah, it's not like... Well, then it's not like Chess Armageddon.
Don't call it super. Just super call it just means... Over.
Cricket
super
Armageddon.
Just means more. Is that not what it means? Essentially, it just means a bit extra.
Yeah. Congratulations to Owen Morgan, captain of England's first ever Cricket World Cup winning team. Dublin born and reared, of course, which gave rise to the rather odd experience of watching him being asked if his team had the look of the Irish yesterday. I do love his answer, though.
We had Allah with us as well. I spoke to Adil. He said Allah was definitely with us. And I said we had the rub of the green. Actually epitomises our team. It's quite diverse backgrounds and cultures, and guys grow up in different countries and are at the stage of where they're at in their career. But to actually find humour in the situation that we were in at the time was pretty cool.
Well played, Owen Morgan, for that sentiment and also for playing well and being the captain of the England team winning the World Cup. I think it's great. It's just bizarre that half an hour period or so when the tennis was still going on and the cricket was hitting fever pitch, my legs were like jelly.
It was.
There was adrenaline. There was a lot going on.
It was crazy. And it was also, you know, they're quite good sports to double screen with. You know, like I find trying to double screen a soccer match and a Gaelic football match to be utterly pointless because you're not watching either of them. You know, you're like... The ball is constantly in movement in both games, therefore you're missing most of the nuance, therefore what the hell are you doing? But with tennis and cricket, there's so many stoppages that between every ball being bowled, particularly the last couple of overs when the field was being changed constantly by Owen Morgan and Ben Stokes, you could actually flick back to the tennis, watch entire points, and then go much more effectively between the two sports than you would otherwise. I mean, this is a key life skill that we're talking about here, I mean, this is basically, you know, we're getting down to the nub of 21st century living now. Which sports can you most effectively double screen? This is important.
While firing
shit
out the odd tweet.
To be honest, I did actually leave Twitter alone. Twitter was the major casualty yesterday. There just wasn't enough time.
Probably not a bad screens. Thing.
Well, I could have got my phone involved, but to be honest, at that stage...
What are you doing? It's just like, what am I, the lawnmower man here?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
A joke.
Hey, everyone, I'm consuming sport. Are you consuming sport? You know, come on.
You won't be surprised. Do you want to come in there further?
No. I saw there's plenty of people tweeting about Owen Morgan, that he's Irish and whatever. It was a bit... It reminded me a bit of the all the English commentators in 1988 talking about the Irish, the so-called Irish team. You know what I mean? It's good to see that Irish people are capable of being really tedious about that as well.
Oh, yeah, don't worry about that.
You won't be surprised to hear that Jonathan Liu has written a brilliant piece all about England's World Cup win. We'll chat to him about that tomorrow on the Second Captain's World Service. Also on the World Service this week, we'll cover the Open Golf in Portrush and...
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
Episode 4 of the Second Captains, I'll Tell You Who Wrote It book club is coming up this Friday. Our book reviewer is head coach of the Italian rugby team, Conor O'Shea, we're delighted to say. He's been reading for us and you The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGuinness, which is the story of a small club from a tiny village in the mountains of southern Italy who get promoted all the way up to Serie B in the mid-90s, which is where the author catches up with them, follows them around, and generally makes a spectacular nuisance of himself. It's really good stuff. O'Mahony's booksellers in Limerick tell us this one has been jumping off the shelves since we announced it a few weeks back. So thanks to everyone who's getting 30 involved in the whole thing. Loads of great stuff going on this week on the World Service. Membership costs €5 a month plus VAT. And you can sign up now on secondcaptains.com. As for today's show, we'll have the excellent Caitlin Thompson of Racket Magazine on the epic Wimbledon final between Federer. Yay! And Djokovic. Boo. And with everyone
I don't know why
I'm just doing what the Wimbledon crowd were doing, you know. With everything going on yesterday, you could have been forgiven for missing the biggest news of the lot, Ken. It came in the middle of a typically humdrum update from Jim Gavin speaking here to Dubs TV. Stay with this, don't get too bored. There is some actual big news in here.
Last night's game was tough. A lot of tired bodies this morning, but you know, the guys will get as much recovery as they can. They'll go back to work in the morning, but we'll try and get a couple of sessions in this week. And you know, it's good we had got James McCarthy back on the pitch, Owen Merchan, Johnny Cooper, Jim O'Connolly's back training with us, Rob McDavid's back. Yeah.
So two bits of news there. The lads are going, or they will be returning to work. So that's good
Monday,
for all the employers. And Dermo's back.
Dermo's back. There were a lot of WhatsApp messages yesterday. I mean, I do love the idea of this. Jim Gavin doing it in such a Jim Gavin way. Like, you just got to applaud the man. It's like probably sitting there yesterday after the game, begging some journalist to ask him, is Jim O'Connolly back? Sorry, Jim, for the 27th time, is Jim O'Connolly back? Yeah, he is actually back. Next question. And then he has to go on, like, you know, a YouTube channel to announce the biggest news of the GAA summer. It's pretty good.
You look happy, Ken.
Well, I am happy. I was outside Gaffney's after the game on Saturday.
You weren't at the game, of course, but you were outside Gaffney's.
I was mingling with my fellow Blues outside Gaffney's in Fairview. And they were telling me. I said I heard that we lost. I thought we'd lost to Leash or something. They said that was hurling. I said, right. And it turned out that we'd won we'd won the football, which is all I care about.
Yep.
But nobody knew about Dermot coming back.
No, it's Sunday morning. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can imagine the celebrations would have gone on and on.
Oisin McConville and Mike Wrecker on the way to talk football. That's after we remind you that Novak Djokovic is up to 16 Grand Slams now, just 2 behind Rafa Nadal and 4 behind Roger Federer, and time is on Djokovic's side. Are we going to have to start facing up to the idea that when this era is all done and dusted, it could be the not especially popular Novak Djokovic who goes down as the greatest of all time? I know Federer fans everywhere are turning off the podcast as I utter those lines. Caitlin Thompson of Racket Magazine, what do you reckon?
It's inevitable. I think it's going to happen no matter what. What we can choose to do as fans of tennis, regardless of who we support, is decide whether or not Grand Slams are the most important factor.
But are we doing that purely because everybody loves Federer? And even though Grand Slams up until this point in history have always been seen as the most important factor, we're now going to finesse the whole thing to find some way to keep Roger number one, even if Djokovic ends up with 25 Grand Slams.
Okay, one small bone to pick. They have not always been the most important. Usually the tour events and the number of overall titles actually used to be sort of the bigger count, kind of before the Steffi Graf, who has 22, and Pete Sampras, who had 14. Before these guys started racking up titles, it used to be sort of more about the overall titles you had. This is week in, week out. Did you win Rome? Did you win Toronto? And then sometime in the last 15 or so years, we started counting Grand Slams. Now, again, you can measure GOAT greatest of all time, however you want to. A lot of people consider Martina Navratilova, who has the most titles in singles, doubles, and mixed doubles, the best of all time, just given her record. Some people think Chris Evert, given her win percentage, which is the highest men and women. You know, you can parse this however you want to. But I think no matter what, the question you're asking is, how can all of us get our minds around Novak Djokovic? Some of us don't like him all that much, despite his incredible continued success beating our faves, Federer and Nadal. And, you know, to a lesser degree, Andy Murray. So, yeah, we're just going to have to deal with it because he's here to stay. He's going to get a lot more. And if this weekend's performance was any indication, we're dealing with probably the best player in the world who has been that way for some time.
You say it's inevitable that he will catch up with Federer, and we shouldn't forget that Nadal is there just a couple behind Federer as well. But you think it's inevitable that he'll surpass both of those guys over the next 5 or 6 years?
Unless something catastrophic happens in terms of his health, or what I would like to see happen, actually, is a return to a real differentiation among surfaces. Because what you have right now is you have essentially pretty fast clay courts and pretty slow grass courts. Mm. You know, the point has been made that if Roger Federer had been playing on grass that was true fast grass for the past decade, kind of after they changed it to make it a little bit more competitive so that serve and volleyers didn't always win, he might have 5 or 6 more. I don't disagree with that, and that takes nothing away from Novak Djokovic, but the defensive style of play that he's really perfected, and actually, if you want to look at the women, Simona Halep and Angelique Kerber and others as well, the real attacking style of tennis that I think is why so many of us really love Roger, and, you know, to a lesser degree, Nadal maybe, is because we like to see that sort of creation on the court instead of counterpunching. I think the surface has a lot to do with it, and if grass were to return to that very, very, very fast serve and volley preference sort of game, we might see some new blood in the upper echelons.
There was a moment in the final set yesterday that I thought was fascinating. Federer appealed to Hawkeye and was proven correct, won the point. Djokovic began to make a bit of a deal about this because if the ball hadn't originally been called out, he felt he would have returned it and the rally could have gone on. Technically, Djokovic was probably in the wrong, but you can see why he might be a little bit pissed off with this. Immediately, the crowd starts booing him, like really booing him mercilessly. This is the Wimbledon champion, about to be Wimbledon champion again, number one player in the world. And it just drove home what you say, that he's just never going to be as well liked. But what struck me, you do have to admire the guy, that he can just ignore that, or maybe not even ignore it, maybe internalize it and use it to drive him on.
One of the best things I've read in a very long time, and I actually have to admit to both of you that I'm pretty angry that Racquet Magazine did not publish this because it's brilliant, is Brian Phillips, who's a writer for The Ringer.
Yeah.
He's written the definitive piece about Djokovic and how he's managed to become this, as you say, 16 Grand Slam time champion. And he's done it in the spite of pretty much universal hatred, probably with the exception of some parts of Eastern Europe. And if not outright hatred, then certainly ambivalence. I mean, he kind of notes that, you know, Djokovic's march to inevitable victory in a lot of these tournaments is accompanied by a kind of polite applause. And then, you know, of course, one of the other guys gets it and it's roaring, thunderous, you know, standing ovations. And he kind of makes the interesting point that I agree with, which is Djokovic's lack of love has fueled him. It's made him this superhuman being. He doesn't need our love. He's going to succeed in spite of it, in fact. And it's made him this incredibly, you know, impenetrable fortress of superior mind control. And you could see it happen yesterday. I mean, Roger Federer, with the entire support of pretty much the entire Western world, certainly that stadium, had 2 match points on his racket, was serving for the match at 2 separate points. Thunders, boos. At times, Djokovic seemed to sort of, you know, antagonize the crowd. And I've heard it said that he at some points imagines the crowd is chanting his name. So he's able to achieve this sort of zen-like presence in the face of, you know, pretty much universal derision and somehow use it to make his tennis better. It's pretty remarkable. If nothing else, what he's not doing on the court but doing in his mind might be even better than what he's managing to achieve, you know, actually hitting a ball over a net. It's unfathomable.
Yeah, he literally said in the press conference afterwards that when they shout Roger, I hear Novak, which is like, what is going, like, that is one of the craziest things I've ever heard, and yet is also admirable.
It's something else. We had a it recalls a when I was a little kid, we used to play G.I. Joes, which might not have been a big deal in Ireland, but essentially they're little army men.
Yeah.
And everybody, sooner or later, everyone wants to be the villain because the villain's like super powerful and has mind control. And it's reminiscent of this. He's Destro from G.I. Joe. He's the ultimate mind sort of over matter example of what an athlete can do to achieve transcendence. And he's doing it in a way that not very many of us want him to do or like what he's doing. And I, you know, you have to sort of applaud the sheer just scale and achievement of it, but you don't have to like it. So, and I think that's where a lot of us are left. I personally am pretty devastated after that match watching, you know, I try not to be a partisan myself, but watching Federer have two match points and lose that match somehow with literally every statistic going in his favor, service games, points won, percentage of returns, percentage of winners to errors. He won more points. He won more games. He was not broken until the very last set. The fact that he won by every measure that we have to measure tennis in terms of statistics, yet still lost, is a real indication of the cruel mistress that is tennis. Like, it's nuts. You know, Djokovic, on the points that matter, found a way, and Federer got a little bit tight. You know, this match was decided by about 4 points, which is just baffling, but also the sport that we love. So I personally am a little devastated, but I think the right take on this is to just sort of throw your hat up in the air and say, wow, Djokovic has achieved a state. Maybe he's accessing another realm of existence. It's hard to know, but he's done it. And something's got to explain yesterday, and that seems like just as good an explanation as anything else.
Why don't you like Djokovic then?
I think his need to be loved is a little bit repellent. And for me, it extends beyond the sport to what the players do with their lives. But if anyone doesn't know this, not only is Djokovic the number one player in the world by rankings, and now obviously the sitting Wimbledon champion, but he also runs what's known as the ATP Player Council, which elects the CEO for the ATP, which is the men's tour. And in his leadership capacity, he's essentially created a way for Justin Gimelstab, a disgraced, mediocre talent of the tennis world, but somebody who's been very vocal and very good about leveraging power, to essentially put himself in the running for CEO. Not even a felony conviction last fall here in the States, where he punched a man, resulted in him being disgraced enough from the sport that this isn't still a possibility. And the main thing that Justin and Djokovic want to do is bring the men again and ahead of the women for equal pay. Now, equal pay, I'm not going to, you know, argue the pros and cons, but it's so regressive and it's so unnecessary. And for me, beyond the court, a lot of what he does that sort of speaks to that, you know, is really problematic. And so for me, not only do I not like a counterpunching style, and his need to be like just does feel a little bit beneath a professional athlete, despite the fact that he doesn't get it, and when it doesn't work, he somehow made stronger, like, you know, a villain. But also the equal pay stuff for me is just really, really tough. Now, I used to work at Time Magazine, and I interviewed the guy 10 years ago. He's quite personable. He's quite funny. This is during the era of impressions, kind of before he found his guru and, you know, decided to eat, I don't know, only raw foods or whatever it is that he does. You know, so it was a sort of different experience, and I quite liked him. But in the past decade or so, I found it harder and harder to sort of get my mind around him. Also, I'm ready for these new guys. Can we talk about the young guys? Where are they?
Yeah, where are they? This is a question we've been asking on the podcast, and I don't know. Well, we know where Nick Kyrgios is. He's in the Dog and Whistle, or whatever the name of the boozer is, the night before he's playing.
I saw him there.
Dog and Fox. Yeah, yeah.
I was in London last week. I saw him last Saturday night leaving.
Okay.
Leaving the bar around 1 a.m. He had a match the next day. You know, God bless him, Nick Kyrgios. What a shambling mess he is. But I love him. I love his game. And I love the fact that he can actually beat Djokovic. He's got a 2-0 record against him, I believe. He's never lost a set. You know, I'm ready for a chaos agent to sort of break up the gentlemanly era of excellence, if you know what I mean. We could talk about Stefanos Tsitsipas from Greece. We could talk about Alexander Zverev from Germany. We could talk about Dominic Thiem from Austria. Thiem is obviously the closest to sort of breaking through. He's got two Grand Slam final appearances, losing both to Rafa at the French Open, which, you know, Everybody loses to Rafa at the French Open. So that's the fact that he got to a final, I think, is pretty good. But it's interesting because this sort of generation is the one that comes after the generation that came after the big three. So you have this sort of lost era of 25 to 30 year olds, because the ones that I was just mentioning are all under 24. Team's the oldest, and everybody else, Kyrgios included, is sort of somewhere around 22, 23, I think. You know, there's a whole generation that just got eaten alive by these dudes. And for me personally, I like variety, so I'm ready for them to sort of step up. And I think they will. It's just give them another year or two.
Yeah, I don't know, because you look at the mentality. Kyrgios is just a lawn to himself, it seems. I mean, he was boasting about winning that tournament in Hawaii a while back while being out, you know, drinking the night before every game till 2 or 3 in the morning. So he's almost a law unto himself. But guys like Bautista Agut I know he's not a young player, but he's been around a while. He was in the semi-final against Djokovic, having originally booked his stag weekend for that week. So he wasn't this is a guy ranked around the top 20 in the world, just outside, not backing himself to get as far as the quarterfinals, semifinals of Wimbledon. Like, do a few of these people have too much scar tissue from all the beatings they've taken over the years from the big three?
Yeah, it's hard to sort of blame them. I mean, you know, I think if any of us were faced with the prospect of being quite good at a sport, winning mostly day in and day out, and then routinely getting beaten by the top three in your sport, I think most of us would take that and make a couple millions between tournaments and endorsements every year. You know, I think that'd be pretty nice. I think it takes some sort of extra special, insane medal and desire to really best your own sort of internal standards to look at the field and say, I'm beating 95% of the people. I'm going to work doubly hard and train and add specific elements to my game so that I can beat the last remaining three who I cannot possibly get past. And that, what we're talking about, is Andy Murray. That is why Andy Murray is so beloved, because Andy Murray comes from that lost generation. Andy Murray was not the most gifted, talented, natural player. When you look at a comparison between, you know, Djokovic's defense and sort of Nadal's, you know, swashbuckling all court, and then obviously Roger's attacking tennis, Andy Murray is the embodiment of somebody who didn't have to do better, but he did. And that's why so many people in the tennis world love him. And I have to say, I was in London for the past, 10 days or so, and getting to watch him play doubles, especially mixed doubles with Serena Williams, was a profoundly moving and exciting experience to have. You don't see a lot of new things like that in tennis. It was exciting to see him. He looked happy. And, you know, here's a guy who might not ever make it back to singles, but it was sort of incredible to watch him just soak up the love of people who realized that they didn't have to say goodbye to him yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an example of the lost generation who kind of, that's what you needed to do to break through those big three, just totally sacrifice your body. And the fact that he became, you know, catastrophically injured from his efforts is not surprising.
It didn't happen for Serena in the final on Saturday. Were you as shocked as much of the tennis world seemed to be by this, by the ease of Simona Halep's win?
Yeah, I actually was. I thought Halep obviously played a flawless match. I think she committed 3 unforced errors the entire 2 sets. You know, that said, I had gotten a chance to see Serena in the lead up to the matches between doubles and singles, and she was looking pre-mom Serena. She was looking in form. The serve was working. The movement was working. She was hitting her volleys well. Serena has sort of atrophied in the volley department. She used to play a ton of doubles with her sister. I think playing doubles with Andy Murray kind of reignited that part of her game, which helps her close out points. I'm shocked, to be honest. I think a lot of people will tell you, like, oh, Simona Halep, you know, she entered the year ranked number 1. She's obviously got another Grand Slam and made a couple of other finals. This is no slight to her whatsoever, because I quite like her. I think she's absolutely tenacious. And obviously she deserved the victory in 56 minutes. I mean, geez Louise. That said, Serena, this is a huge disappointment for Serena. The fact that she didn't really even compete, I think more than anything, shows that she just got insanely tight. She had absolutely no reason. Usually you can blame it on her fitness, because she sort of famously, since coming back, has not trained, has not played enough tournaments, you know, and obviously has sort of paid the price in the later stages of tournaments. This wasn't a failure of fitness. This was a failure of, I think, her ability to show up and contend, and a real sense from the other competitors in the field that she's vulnerable now. You know, Serena used to win a few points before she even got on the court, just given how you know, demoralized she used to make opponents because they knew they would have to throw the kitchen sink at her to even make a dent. That's no longer the case. Serena does not sort of benefit from that aura of invincibility. And more than anything else, I think it just means so much to her that she got unbelievably tight playing that match. And frankly, this surface in this part of her career is the best and easiest way for her to get what it's so clear that she wants, which is 24 Grand Slams. So it's going to be hard to imagine how she's going to manage the rest of the year. It's really flummoxing, to be honest, to see what happened to her and understand what's going to happen next. But, you know, Serena's contains multitudes. Who knows how she'll react or what kind of game she'll bring to the remainder of the season.
I know you've got your own tennis match to go and play there, Caitlin. So I'm just going to ask you one more question. I know you've got to get into the zone over the next 20 minutes or so. So
that's right.
That question is, you said earlier that you seem to be willing to refuse to give Djokovic the greatest of all time title, no matter how many Grand Slams you win. So what criteria are you going to use or possibly invent to keep Roger Federer in that position?
Well, you're assuming that I want to keep Roger Federer in that position.
Okay. No?
It's probably Federer, greatest of all time men's edition, because let's still give the greatest of all time by Grand Slam measures to Serena Williams.
Yep.
I think for me, what I love so much about tennis is the ability certain players have to inspire. And what Federer has that very, very few others, Serena Williams also has it, maybe not as much in measure, is just the ability to gobsmack people with the beauty of the game played right. And, you know, you can take issue with my use of the word right, but truly, truly watching Roger Federer float around a tennis court, seemingly hovering a few inches off the ground, playing incredibly graceful one-handed backhand attacking tennis, really is truly, you know, something to behold. It's inspired books and essays and films. And I think that that's what people respond to when they think of him. You can also sort of see it as a throwback notion of what the game's supposed to look like, as opposed to somebody like Nick Kyrgios, who plays it in a more maybe exciting way, more modern way. But I think, to me, that's the measure of greatness. How many people in their hearts and minds can you convert with the beauty of what you're doing on the court? You know, otherwise, what are we stuck with? A Djokovic Grand Slam finalist of all time? We can't have that. So I think that's my answer. I don't know how it sounds, but
perfect.
You can tell me.
Sounds good to us. No, sounds good, Caitlin. We'll let you get on and hopefully win your match. Thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
It was totally insane. Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. It's coming back to me now. Oh, my God.
What happened?
After the game, I came back on the metro from the stadium to Nevsky Prospect.
It was like basically Russian Arthur's Day.
They're all beating their horns. They like rev their engines.
You've got terror of death. You think you're going to die.
Loads of people had these balloons of what I assumed was laughing gas.
Hippie crack. Raheem Sterling hippie crack.
I was sorely tempted. I was like, I really should try that.
What happens if I fall over and hit my head?
And then I watched as a girl took a great big out of this balloon, and sort of went, and was sort of giggling, and then just eyes rolled back in the head, and she just fell backwards like poof. A couple of minutes after that, so this time a man, probably 30-ish, pitched forward onto his face. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this just happened again. Smashed down onto the concrete with his chin.
He'll never chew normally again. He's gonna be half dead.
But in fact, again, he was all right.
Old titanium jaw.
What a night. What a city. What an adventure for the host nation.
I should say at this point, Ken, now that we've talked about the match and everyone's at peace with it,
yeah,
you can make the point that you've been itching to make all day. You weren't as blown away as many others by the standard on offer by in this Federer.
I thought it was a bit tedious. It reminded me of the one time I've been to center court was in the Olympics, and it was your man Del Potro,
mm-hmm,
against, was it Federer?
In what round?
Like the semi-finals of the Olympics.
Trying to remember the semi-finals of a tennis
Wimbledon.
Olympics, you'd be doing well.
Well, look.
This year's Wimbledon.
But it was like...
I remember Murray winning the final anyway. Yeah,
I actually left before the end because I was like, this is nonsense.
Maybe you just don't like tennis.
No, I do like... I do quite like tennis. I mean, I'm like everyone. I can take it or leave it. Mostly leave it. But occasionally.
That's not like everyone. It's quite a globally popular sport.
I will watch the Wimbledon semifinals and final.
Yeah.
So I was watching the Federer Nadal. I thought the Federer Nadal game on Friday was much better.
It was very good, yeah.
I thought it was way better. I started off supporting Federer, but by the end I was supporting Nadal again. I was back supporting Nadal because I don't know what it is about that guy. Just when he plays Federer, I think it's because he's not as talented, but he always kind of. I mean, I could say the same thing about Djokovic, but there's something about Djokovic I just don't really like. So I want Federer to win this against Djokovic. I mean, he's way better. He's way better. He's just an old man now. Djokovic could barely beat an old man who is far more talented than he is and far more entertaining to watch. But the match itself, I thought was, it was like it seemed like most of the points were scored by, double faults by Djokovic a lot of the time. But like shots that were too hard for the player who was returning to really control the return. So it goes into the net or it goes long.
You didn't see any of the winners, any of the drop shots?
There weren't many though, Owen. Where are the winners?
I don't even know if it should pull you up on your Djokovic being nowhere near Federer's level. He's been beating him up and down for years.
He just hits the ball really hard. And Federer's old.
Federer's old now, but Djokovic has had a winning record against him for quite a long time.
He hits the ball really hard. He's like a tennis killer robot. Like, he's just bang, hit the ball really hard. What are you going to do about that? Oh, hit it back into the net. All right, well, you know.
Hitting hard isn't part of the talent
it's
of being
great,
a tennis
but it's just,
player.
It's not my favorite part of the game.
No, look, I'm now trying to argue against Federer, which I just will not do.
Yeah, you know what I like, Owen?
But I think it's incredible.
What I'm watching for in tennis when I watch?
Yeah.
Creativity.
Yeah.
Ingenuity.
Well, there.
That's
your man.
That's what I'm looking for. And I just think Federer's got it. And Djokovic just hits the ball really hard. And fair play to him. He's like a machine. He's like a autonomous military robot that just goes and destroys the opposition by pounding them into oblivion. And he's the best at that, and fair play to him, but I just would like to see a real tennis player win Wimbledon this time around.
Oisin has landed in. Hi, Oisin.
All in his form.
Pretty good. And Mike Quirk is ready to purr over Kerry's performance. How are you, Mike?
Purring all weekend.
Yeah. Well, the town was purring. I mean, it looked like a great... the match obviously didn't catch up with the... match up to the occasion. But what was the occasion like, first of all? Did that part of it live up to things?
Yeah, the occasion was super. Yeah, I mean, it was one of those kind of memories as a kid to stay with you for a long, long time. You know, the temperature was so hot. The traffic was bonkers. The tarmac lifting off the road. You know, one of those ones that you remember like for 20 years down the line. You remember going to that game with your dad and you know, it sticks out in your head. Because like a sellout in Killarney obviously is very unusual when it's not a Cork Kerry Munster final or whatever. So the whole atmosphere around the town, and I'd say Saturday evening more so than even the Sunday, was just bonkers. And it was the way, I suppose, that the Super 8s were kind of envisaged when they first kind of came into Pádraig Duffy's into his head, and you know, that was a good example of it, I suppose, on Sunday.
Oisin, how did you find it? Were you pretty much in and out?
Absolute nightmare. I thought I'd be smart about it and come in from Tarbert, Listowel, and into Killarney that way, and it was working so well. And then I came to the point where Kerry people were starting to park, and Mayo people thought that it might have been a good idea. But I had my sat nav on, and it was 2.6 kilometers to the thing, and I thought there's absolutely no way I'm walking 2.6 kilometers in that heat. So I managed to blag my way in past a band guard who, if she is listening, thank you very much. And I got up to close to where the Legion football club is, and I walked in that way. But the atmosphere was electric, and you knew it as soon as you seen the people starting to park. It was electric. It was a great buzz about it. Mayo fans bring that anyway, and I found that when I was down in Castlebar. It was something special about that group of supporters. And it was great to see so many Kerry people there, because any time I've been in Croke Park, I haven't seen that many of them. So I hope to follow it through. I really do. I know I'm joking with that, but I really hope to follow it through. I hope all those Kerry
football-wise, supporting-wise.
Like, I mean, because they have something that, you know, they have a team that's going places as well. So I hope they go and support them now.
Yeah, Mike, the kind of the Kerry dander was up from maybe the middle of the week. We were talking about Kieran Donaghy sending out a tweet to, you know, imploring Kerry fans to go to Killarney for a football game. And it did seem a little weird. And like the tone was set, even at the throw-in with David Moran getting stuck into Aidan O'Shea and that. It did kind of seem that for whatever reason, you know, Kerry people had convinced themselves that it was all on the line on Sunday. And, you know, the fact that they that this team performed under that sort of pressure must actually be very encouraging.
Oh, for sure. No, most of Danny's tweets would be kind of weird, to be honest. But, like, I mean, if you look at what Kerry were facing, you know, after not having a great Munster Championship, after being beaten by Mayo in a league final, after being beaten by Mayo in the, you know, the league proper blow on Tralee, like, this was the one team that had beaten them all year. And they had done kind of, they had really kind of exposed Kerry's kind of perceived weaknesses in terms of, you know, defensively not great, midfield not great leadership around the place. We can put your goalkeeper under pressure. And it was seen as a big kind of a game. And while it wasn't a knockout game, it still had that kind of a feel to it for Kerry people, because you really didn't want to be heading up to Croke Park next weekend to play Donegal, who have been, you know, next to Dublin, as we've said, the second best team in the country so far. And like facing into that game with no points, it could have been looking at a similar scenario to what happened last year, where you lose, or sorry, you get 1 point out of 4 points of in the Super 8s in the first two games last year, and you're pretty much done by the time Kildare come to town. So it was, from that point of view, like, while it wasn't knockout, it just Kerry people really, really had that in their head that this is a game we really have to win. And you know that Mayo people are going to come in their droves, and like it was almost, while Dave Moran took on the challenge, like, in the middle of the field right before the game even started, Kerry supporters kind of did the same thing by coming in such numbers. And I know that might sound like, Jesus, well done, lads, you went to Killarney for a game in your home county. But, you know, Kerry supporters are like that, and it takes something to get them going, and that game certainly got them going.
Yeah, we thought that stuff even before the throw-in, that was getting everybody going, and it looked like, oh, you know, this is a bit different. But it only worked on one side. You know, Aidan O'Shea, like the whole of the Mayo team, or it's unfair, but a lot of the Mayo team was fairly, it just wasn't a factor for much of the day. I don't know what happened. Maybe just zero in on him for a moment, because he's the type of player that has to produce in those games for Mayo, and he didn't.
Yeah, and my biggest thing about Aidan O'Shea was yesterday was I just didn't think he had a partner in crime. You know, right. I thought that they just lacked that somebody who had that running ability and that little bit of energy. Donny Vaughan got forward three times, took the wrong option three times, and that just, every time he did that, it sort of seemed to drain them even further.
Yeah, he went to four quite early on, a big meandering run, ends up losing the ball, tries to win it back, but he looked knackered, and there was no need to be knackered because he didn't have to go running with the ball for that long. It was just a lot of bad decisions.
Yeah, no, even the one after that one where he had the ball, ended up getting a little bit flummoxed, had the shot, comes back to him. He's got to give that ball to Killian O'Connor, and Kerry come up the field and get a score. It sucks the energy right out of it, because Mayo needed a spark. They needed something to spark them. But the biggest difference between, well, let's talk about Aidan O'Shea. Like, he just, you know, go back to Mike's analogy of him. You know, it seemed to be a little bit back to that, but I don't think, to be honest, we don't want to be defending him, but I don't think that was entirely his fault. I think there was a lack of, like, apart from Lee Keegan, you know, that first run, got the first score, and you thought, yeah, that's sort of what we needed, because who was going to replace those runs from Paddy Durkin? And he did that initially, and it never happened after that. And it looked to be purely down to energy. And energy, you get energy from certain things in the game. You get energy from scores. You get energy from blocks. You get energy from turnovers. You get energy from winning the ball in the middle of the field. And they weren't doing any of that, certainly not on a consistent basis. And when they went up front, like the naivety of the Mayo runs was the thing that probably most annoyed me on the day.
Tell us about that, because watching on TV, you mightn't see much.
Yeah, okay. Well, like, if you look at Clifford's runs, it's diagonal runs. It's runs across the 21. So you see Clifford and Geaney yesterday. The majority of the time, those were the two who spent most of the time up front together. But you see the 99% of their runs, they're getting the ball no further than the middle of the D. And you see Mayo's forwards, and the ball's coming in, somebody looks up, it's that straight run out. And all it is then is a foot race. There's nothing, there's no nuance about it, you know, from a forward point of view. It's just a foot race. And Foley was very good yesterday. Cohen scored 3 points off him, but I thought Foley sort of was very good. Enright came in and did a job that we've been sort of asking from somebody from Kerry, and that is just to be a bit of a dog and be physical.
So just the problem with those runs you're talking about is, A, you're just making a 50-50 battle, and B, even if you do get the ball, you're not necessarily in a brilliant position.
You're 50 yards from the goal, and you're usually on the wing.
Yeah, and also, if you hit a pass diagonally, it's basically the forward has a circle around which he can run to get the ball. If you're running straight out to a ball, to a straight pass, first of all, the pass has to be bang on the money, and you're still facing the kicker as you receive the ball. Whereas if you're getting things on the half turn, I mean, you saw Clifford. Like, Clifford doesn't need to beat anyone. He receives the ball in the half turn, and then he can just swing the ball over from anywhere inside the D. You know?
Yeah, and Clifford and Gagini gives you the opportunity to use your body. Okay, so you talk about that circle. It gives you an opportunity to use your body, whereas in the other way of coming out, a defender just needs to get that. He just needs to have that on the ball, and then... You know,
a fist through your underarm.
Yeah,
no one can see that.
He just needs to get a fist in the ball. Anything on the ball, anything, just a bit of a touch, knock it away, and then the whole momentum of that is stopped, and then it gives an opportunity for Kerry to get some sort of basis. But the biggest thing about Kerry yesterday was, and we talk about how good they were up front, but Kerry did not change the formula yesterday from what they have done. They still went man-to-man. And so if you want to improve and you're not changing your system, individuals have to improve. They changed, they took Gavin Crowley on from the start. They played Enright from the start. And those two made a distinctive difference, as well as Teg Morley, who is fairly physical, and Foley, who is like I know I've said it before, but he's like the next fullback in the waiting for me from Kerry. And he played the majority of his underage football, and I sort of kept an eye on him. I remember watching him against Cork in a minor match one time, and I just thought he was one for the future and probably be fullback. But it's taken him a little bit of time, and you know, he's filled into that cornerback slot. And even though Cohen, as I say, got 3 points yesterday, two of those weren't even directly off him. It was just sort of loose play. But I thought he was really, really good.
Talk to us a little bit, Mike, about the Mayo kickouts, because obviously Kerry, we'll be talking about kickouts for the entirety of this chat, because you know it was a huge factor in a lot of the games. But the Kerry's focus on the Mayo kickout was, we're not going to give you the short one, and we're going to hammer you on the long ones. And you know, we saw David Moran was just magisterial in the air, like absolutely magnificent. But there was certainly an element as well of checking Aidan O'Shea off the ball. I know Adrian Spillane got caught for one, I think. But like Daryl O'Shea, like your old sparring partner, has written about this in the past, that you know it's going to come, so you still have to be able to get yourself into the game. And it didn't happen for Aidan O'Shea. Like, just talk to us a little bit about that battle, what Kerry did to make sure that Aidan O'Shea wasn't jumping all that often with David Moran to catch these kickouts.
Yeah, well, tactically, I suppose Kerry pushed up their half backs really into the you know, that Mayo 65, so that when David Clark was putting down the ball on the tee to take a kick out, all he was seeing in front of him was those gold jerseys all over the place, and they really just took every little bit of space that they could inside in that 65, which is kind of within David Clark's range. He's not like a Sean Patton, who we'll probably talk after about, who can kick it over the top. He probably doesn't have that in his locker. So the only one that they really were giving up was that short little dinky one to the left over in front of the stand that they got maybe two or three from over there. But even when they did do that, the pressure then that the Kerry forwards put on him made it so difficult for Mayo to get the ball up the field. It just took so much energy and effort to try and get the ball past the halfway. So what it really relegated Clark to doing a lot of the time was saying, I got to go back here to 1970 and punt the ball up for grabs. But the strange thing was, most of the times he put it up for grab, it was towards Moran and Vaughan as opposed to Aidan O'Shea and Adrian Spillane. And funnily enough, Adrian Spillane was a guy like who, you know, he wouldn't be massively regarded in Kerry. He's very athletic. He's abrasive. He always has a really big tackle count every game he plays. But he did actually a really, really good job on Aidan O'Shea. Now, I know O'Shea came into it in the second half a little, but Spillane still won two or three kickouts that were kicked to Aidan O'Shea yesterday. And again, he was, again, like O'Shea mentioned, energy. That was the big thing all around that middle of the field sector. Like, even if Mayo got the ball off to one of their own, it was the energy and the effort and the work rate of those Kerry players in that sector that really kind of dictated the game. And like with their tackling, and like if it wasn't to be won by Moran, who caught about, it must have been five or six, and it felt like about 16, it was a Kerry were winning a break, or, you know, Gavin White or Stephen O'Brien or somebody. And they were the ones. And those kind of plays are really based on, like, how am I feeling here? Like, do I have a lot of juice in my legs to go and make that extra tackle and to dive on that break? And Kerry were the ones that were just, that completely dominated that sector. But it wouldn't have been as easy without the whole tactical idea of just pushing those extra bodies up into that 65 and forcing them to put it up for grabs.
Yeah, it's all connected, exactly. You know that there, you know, you can't just change one part without changing lots of other parts of your game. But Oisín reckons there was no real difference in shape, but there was a difference in personnel and a difference in attitude in Kerry. Would you agree, or pretty much, with that?
Yeah, I thought there was, like, the shape wasn't hugely different. I thought Shane Enright kind of helped a little bit more and played kind of tried as often as he could to kind of be a spare guy around the place. He picked up about two or three, kind of intercepted two or three kind of passes that were intended for other guys other than his own. And I just thought, you know, and I spoke about it before, I thought there was a better kind of collective awareness with the Kerry defenders that, you know, normally, like in the last couple of games, we've seen Kerry defending really, like, selfishly one-on-one stuff where I'm worried about my man and I don't really care about where the ball is or what's happening over on the other side of the field. Whereas yesterday that was very different, and guys were, you know, getting 20 yards off their man if their guy was on the really weak side of the play, and they were getting 20 yards into the pitch. So it allowed guys to get inside and intercept those passes. Obviously, the switch was, you know, I'd say Gavin Whitey was probably his first inter-county game, certainly playing at wing forward. He's obviously played all his football at half back, and he had more of a defensive kind of emphasis as well. While he still got forward a couple of times and caused a bit of bother, you could see him getting back a little bit quicker to try and pick up somebody, you know, one of those kind of half forward, sort of to allow that man to try and drop as well. So it wasn't anything major. It was like everybody else is trying to do. They're just trying to get those half forwards back a little bit and allow a little bit of cover. And they definitely did a much better job collectively than we'd seen already this year.
How is this group shaping up, do you think, Oisín, with Meath competitive against Donegal, albeit they were beaten well in the end?
You mean how's Kerry shaping
up? How's the whole group shaping up now? And Kerry, obviously,
I don't think we've really learned much from the weekend's games that we didn't already know. Kerry were phenomenal yesterday. They were so good to watch. Some of the forward play was exceptional, but realistically, like, if they expect that next week, if they expect that to happen, then, you know, they're being very naive. They have a big task on their hands next weekend because of the fact that the majority of the football they played in the first 20 minutes will be null and void when it comes to next weekend. I thought Kerry did mix it up to a certain degree, and that's the facet that I really like about them. But, you know, I'll pick out one where James O'Donoghue put the ball in under pressure and just stuck it in on top of the boys, on top of the two boys. Geaney wanted it initially, I think, and was dispossessed. But against Donegal, that would be absolutely ate up. And so they obviously have to change dramatically. And I don't know if that change is in them. And that's why we're going to have to, you know, wait till the weekend is over and have a go. But my personal view is that there's very, very little between Kerry and Donegal, probably Tyrone as well.
But Mayo are being written out of things now.
No, they're not being written. They're not definitely not being written out of things. They'll still, like the perfect scenario really for everybody is if Mayo were to win next week and it come down to a dogfight
and Kerry win.
Yeah,
and if Kerry beat Donegal and Mayo beat Meath, then it's a winner take all in Castlebar.
And even the other way, there's still something riding on that Mayo Donegal game, because, you know, that could leave the three of them, I think, on 4 points. That'd be right.
If Kerry beat Meath,
yeah.
So I mean, yeah, like there's still plenty of football to be played in it. And you know, if you look at what Meath did against Donegal, I think Meath are capable of playing to that level against the other two teams as well. And it might actually, you know, that performance might get them a lot closer than 10 points to Donegal and to Kerry and to Mayo.
Yeah, I just think that the strange thing is there's certain teams that you know, that Kerry team would be maybe comfortable enough playing against. They're probably comfortable enough playing against Dublin. I don't think they'll beat Dublin. I don't think Donegal will beat Dublin. They'll play against Dublin in a different way. Mayo the same. But I just don't think any of them are quite ready for that step up. So that's what I mean about, you know, we haven't learned that much. I just think that bunch coming behind, you can like, as far as Super 8s is concerned, you know, Roscommon are probably the first team that we can discount by the fact that they play Dublin this weekend. And Meath are obviously, Meath and Mayo, whoever comes out of that game will have something to play for. But you would still expect Mayo to have a little bit too much for them.
Well, let's talk about the big news of the weekend, Mike. That's Dermo back. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life when I heard Jim Gavin come out with it was just so nonchalant, and, you know, yeah, I'm just out walking my dog, and oh look, I found Dermot Connolly wants to come back and play with Dublin. Did I mention that? And then I'll sleep. Like, it was ridiculous, really.
Yeah, apparently just on the release, because we played the clip earlier on, yeah, and just on that, whoever was reading up on it, the journalists have just stopped bothering asking him about it. They were asking for a lot of the year. Now it's like, oh, what's the point? It's just the same old, either non-committal answer or just it's not going to happen, so forget about it. The one time they don't ask, he ends up going onto this Dubs TV afterwards and revealing it in a very casual fashion. But do you think it's the right call?
Well, sure, who knows? I don't know what were the intricacies of why he left in the first place. But, like, I mean, there's so many different kind of twists and angles on this whole idea. And where does he fit in, first of all? Like he was going over to Boston. I have a guy from our club, Barry John Keane, is over playing with Boston, and he was to be playing with him over there. And but for, like, a botched kind of immigration form or whatever it was, he probably would be over there now. Instead, he's potentially going to be an impactful member of the squad who are going to go for a drive for five. And it's just, I can't understand it, really. Like, where what's after changing the last little while? Has Gavin kind of looked at it and said, you know what, we're not getting the same punch off the bench that we have. Maybe we go back to Connolly and see if he's interested now that he's knocking around for the summer. It's just, it's fascinating. And I just think it adds another little dynamic to the whole thing. And while the Super 8s now are catching the imagination and there's some really good games, this is something else now that's going to get people talking and looking to see, is he going to be on the 26th the next day, or is he going to play? And it's great. I look, as a football supporter, you want to see the best players playing, and undoubtedly he's still one of the best players we have in the country.
On a personal level, I think it's great for Dermot Connolly that he's involved with Dublin, because I can imagine how disappointed he is to have missed out on the Boston trip this summer. From a Gaelic football point of view, it's brilliant because he's a brilliant footballer, and, you know, the hope would be that he'd be able to show some of the, you know, just sparkling brilliance that he has. But looking at this from a Dublin point of view, is this not very un-Jim Gavin-like? This is, you know, this is not the Jim Gavin that we have come to know and love over the course of the last 5 years. Like, I just find it very interesting. Like, if this was any other county and they brought back a guy who has been out of intercounty football for 2 years, though not out of the country, not, you know, like, we don't know the reason why he hasn't been playing for the last couple of years, but, you know, it's not like he, you know, everyone was absolutely in the clear, you just wanted a break, that's fine. Like, if I'm Niall Scully or Brian Howard or Cormac Costello.
Do you know what? You're naming starting players. I'd actually, funny enough, I was at the game on Saturday night directly behind the substitutes. Mm. And it's just interesting watching it when you're seeing it close up, because you see how one or two of them, how pissed off they're getting when they're not getting on the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about these big names. They're warming up time and time again. Then they're just sent back to the... I'm not saying they're not throwing a strop. Obviously, they wouldn't be in the panel if they started in that. But you can see them when you're that close and they're sitting down pretty pissed off. And it's like, when am I going to get out there? And they're the ones. You know, so these,
like,
kind of Bernard really
Brogan
big names
hasn't made the 26 yet.
Yes, and even the players who are in the 26 are now another... Potentially, they're a rung below where they are at the moment. And if they're only the second, third, fourth sub at the moment, they might never get on. So I would have thought it's those guys that would be the pissed off ones, more so than potentially... Like, is he going to come straight back into the starting team? No, definitely not. Not straight into the Super 8 starting 15.
Why bring him back then?
Well, to have a
can
the player.
Can I give you a different angle on it?
Yeah.
Right. The more I think about it, the more I think it's very Jim Gavin-like.
Okay.
This is my own personal opinion, and we can no doubt, because this is recorded, we can revisit this. But I feel as if if he's brought him back in. He's given no assurances. I don't think Dave McConnelly would play any football with Dublin this year, and I think this is with a view to, if you stay the course, there's an opportunity for you to play in 2020. I think this is sort of that test for him. Would you guys consider Jim Gavin a fairly intelligent individual?
I would have thought so. Yeah,
extremely intelligent, maybe even.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, like when Jim Gavin said that in the blasé way that he said it, there's no way he didn't think there was going to be like major reverberations around this.
Yeah.
So, doesn't that take away a lot of the focus from what everybody's been talking about, like the drive for five and all those things? And now, what are we talking about today? We're not talking about that. We're not talking about amazing the Dubs are. We're talking about Dave McConnelly and the impact that that would make.
We're also, though, Mike, talking about another thing that's happened this year that hasn't happened in any of the previous 4 years in relation to going for five in a row, which is that they lost three league games, that they brought Rory O'Carroll back at the end of the league. What I would have said, if you're going for something like this, similar to Kilkenny in 2010, nothing changes. It's the exact same as every other year. That's how you treat it. You don't go around doing things massively differently to what you've done other years. Am I mad? Like,
no, I would go completely opposite to O'Shane and think this is the most un-Jim Gavin-like thing that he has ever done in his position as manager of the Dublin football team. Like, what is to be right now? You'd have to say clinically, if Dublin did not add any other pieces to their puzzle, they're probably going to win the All-Ireland, and we're hoping that there'll be challengers, Donegal or Kerry or Mayo or whoever or Tyrone. But you're saying, looking at now, the bookies, everybody is saying Dublin are going to win the All-Ireland. So what is he gaining? Like, what is he gaining out of this? Is he kind of, like, I'm just not sure. Like, I know O'Shane, like, that theory there about, you know, we'll keep your nose clean and we'll see how you go in 2020. But, like, does he need to do that? Can he not ring him in October and say, okay, we're starting with a fresh slate now. If you want to be involved in 2020, you come to training and you do the slog and you get ready and you prepare and we'll see how things go next year. I don't think he needs to give him the carrot of bringing him back now and we'll see how involved we'll make you. This is when Jim Gavin is so, like, remember that big brawl as that happened below and after the league game in Kerry? Like,
yeah.
It was the most robotic thing I've ever seen a human being do. Like, there was about 30 grown men throwing punches and throwing fellas on the floor and everything. And Gavin is walking straight out towards that and then just veers around and he keeps walking and never turns his head once to even look at what, you know, mess is going on behind him. And, like, this guy is so process focused, and this is, I'm going from A to B and I don't need to be diverting myself around here. And, like, this is a complete diversion from what we're used to from him and from what Dublin have given us in the last few years. And that's why I think it's going to be box office and it's going to be so fascinating to see how this all plays out in the next couple of games.
I can't remember exactly what the incident was, but I remember he had a bit of a go after one of the in his press conference after one of the games. Was that what may have also been around a decision that was made or Connolly or something like that?
He was talking about his rights as a citizen of the Republic after the referee, after Connolly pushed the linesman. Was that it?
Maybe so. But so for me, that was an outburst, but I have always said that was strategic. That was something that, you know, he wanted to do because he was deflecting again from certain things that were going on. And maybe, whether Tim has come up with this or somebody else, and they have took him back in, but I'm happy to see Dave McConnelly.
But that was
back.
Other. But surely, okay, if that is the plan, right? Let's say you're totally correct in that interpretation.
Maybe you just have had too much time in the car and have too much time to think.
It's quite warm in the studio as well. The brain gets frazzled. No, but the other players aren't going to know any of that. So you're still left with the situation that you're potentially, now, I don't know, maybe this is overstated. These guys are all but professional athletes. You know, they just have to suck it up. But, like, if this guy is legitimately allowed to be in the squad, he's in the squad. So if you are one of those subs, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter how many All-Irelands you have, you're just not getting on the pitch. You have to deal with it. But they're human beings.
Okay,
and that can lead to envy and that can lead to issues.
Look at it from the other point of view then. Can we look at it from Dave McConnelly coming in and exactly what I said is happening, not getting into 26 and not getting on the team? What does that do for a player? Does that give a player an extra, he's got confidence in me, he's giving me the extra edge? What he's done to Dean Rock. Look what he's done to Dean Rock. You know how aggressive Dean Rock is now in the tackle, how accurate he is. Dean Rock doesn't miss now. He can't, like, we're used to him with a little bit of a chink over the last 18 months to 2 years since that All-Ireland final where he kicked the 10 scores out of 10 scores. Little bit of a difference with Dean Rock now. Maybe maybe that edge went off him a little bit. Probably assured of his place. Sticks in Costello, gives Dean Rock a kick up the hole, and look at the player. Like, even just the snippets that we've seen over the last 2 weeks. Jesus, like, if that man is not playing the next day or within the next couple of weeks, there's something drastically wrong.
And of course, Connolly is flying it. You know, like, the my club up here played them in the senior league. When was that? Like, at the start of this month. And our manager, who was there watching the senior team, is not a man who, you know, spends his days, you know, videoing on his phone senior club league games. But he basically had his phone out because he was standing beside German Connolly. Connolly had scored a goal, having embarked on, like, a 20-yard run, stuck in the top corner with his right foot. Our manager took his phone out 2 minutes later because Connolly got a similar ball. Did the exact same thing with his left foot into the opposite corner, and you're just like,
yeah, he's
okay.
decent enough.
He is
baller.
A decent,
yeah, he's
decent
not a bad addition.
We can all agree on that last bit. I have to say, I was impressed with Cork's attitude, Mike. And I know the scoreline. Look, it's another romp by Dublin, but I think it's more enjoyable. I don't know. Maybe it's not more enjoyable for all concerned. It felt a bit more enjoyable than when a team comes and just tries to defend, and you know they're going to get turned over anyway. At least Cork shot the lights out for periods of the game, but will they gain any confidence from that? They do still ship a heavy beating. They've got this game against Tyrone, which is the real, you know, I guess this is the real game of that group.
Yeah, I think they will. I think they will take something out of it. I mean, if you finish that game after 60 minutes, they were in a great position. They were probably losing the game by 4 or 5 points, and they'd be delighted with it. But as Dublin have done to far better teams than that Cork team, they kill you in that last 10 minutes with their depth and their strength off the bench, and guys, you know, still like Fenton and fellas that are just, you know, they can run for all day, and they do that to teams. They wear you down with their play and with their decision making, with everything they do. But from Cork's point of view, like, I think they'll be looking at the first 60 of that and saying, lads, like, offensively, we were really good. We had a great start. We caused them no end of problems. And this is still, although Johnny Cooper didn't start and James McCarthy, these are still really, really top players that we're talking about here. And we caused them massive problems offensively. But the problem was always going to be for Cork, that they weren't going to have enough to stop, you know, to stop what Dublin were able to do, as no one has enough in the last couple of years. But I still think that they'll take plenty out of it. And facing Tyrone, who obviously, they play in a very different way to Dublin, and they're going to get a lot of bodies behind the ball. But it's not going to be, like, I think it'll suit Cork in one sense, the way that they play, because their running game will just have to become a really, you know, the mainstay of what they do, because they won't be kicking ball into 12 or 13 Tyrone jerseys behind the ball. So they're going to have to carry and create chances and win fouls. And I'm not sure. I just think they'll be equally as competitive, if not more so, against Tyrone next weekend.
Shane?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they've done really, really well. I just kept trying to make a real proper case for them going to play Tyrone, and I just can't see. I can see a way from them being competitive, just not winning the game. But like, what they've done over the last couple of weeks for me has been bang on. It's been good, and they deserve a lot of credit for the way they're playing. So maybe there's an extra layer to them. Maybe there is a bit more to them, and Crow Park next week could be exactly what they need, and just that further challenge. Because along with all the good work, they need to put maybe a big result alongside it now, and Tyrone would be exactly that. And if they were to beat Tyrone, that would absolutely blow the whole thing apart. You know, that group in particular, because then you've got Tyrone versus Dublin and Healy Park with something riding on it.
Yeah, which is not a bad way to end things, but that's the way that group goes. Albeit it might go the complete opposite way.
Yeah,
it'd be a complete dap square, but we'll see. Yeah. Oisin, thanks so much. Mike, thanks a million.
Thanks.
No worries, guys.
Modern day coaching. What is it all about? Paralysis by analysis. Infiltrated by a load of spoofers and bluffers. Fellas with earpieces stuck in their ear. Psychologists, Clive Woodward, statisticians, dietitians. And as Mick O'Connell alluded to, God save us.
It's been such a busy weekend that we haven't even mentioned Kilkenny against Cork in the hurling until now. Murph, until now. Because I do want to give a quick pat on the back to Cork's Patrick Horgan for keeping up a great hurling tradition of heroic individual scoring feats in defeat. This happens quite a lot. Well, not quite a lot, but it, I think maybe more so than in other sports, where if your top guy is shooting the lights out in a lot of sports, it means you win the match. With hurling, there's so many variables, and the team can't be fully reliant on one player. It just doesn't always work that way, that you do get these weird quirks.
Paul Flynn from Watford was renowned for only playing brilliantly in games that Watford ended up losing.
Yeah. So Patrick Horgan scored 10 goals and 10 points would have been even better. 3 goals and 10 points, including one from his knees, one of those goals. Mm. It was the same for Seamus Callanan against Galway a few years back, semi-final.
I think that was 3-9.
3-9, that was. Joe Canning, didn't he put in one of the all-time great debut season before? It was his first season. He'd been held back a little bit. Everyone knew all about him. And then they were beaten by Cork, I think.
Yeah.
And he just was unbelievable in it.
Scored 2-10 off Dermot O'Sullivan.
2-10 in your first season off Dermot O'Sullivan.
When you're like a teenager.
Is not bad. So it is a nice tradition. And sure, what
pretty,
harm?
Pretty annoying tradition. In for the
intensely annoying for the player involved and his teammates.
Do you, I know we just, there's a lot of reaction to Uncle Jim.
Yeah.
On Friday. Do you want a quick Uncle Jim update from his travails around Killarney?
Yeah, sure.
Text message, 8:15 Saturday evening. Greetings from Killarney. Baking hot here tonight. I'm sitting up at the bar in Jimmy O'Brien's discussing Jack McCaffrey with the man beside me, Kerry 1984 captain Ambrose O'Donovan, who he literally was talking about is the king of this pub, Jimmy O'Brien's. Yeah. Bloody hell, small world. Jim Carney is having an excellent time in Kerry.
I'm more updates
if and
that.
When I get them.
Thanks again.
Thanks. I just want to say, I looked up the Federer Del Potro thing.
Yes.
It was the longest 3-set match in the Open era, 4 hours 26 minutes, with the third set ending 19-17, a conclusion which I didn't get to see. As I was like, I can't take it.
I'm glad you weren't at that Isner what's his name match from back in the day, the one that went like 50-48 or whatever it was in the final set. They've brought in these tie breaks that could have happened with Federer and Djokovic. It could have gone on to 50 games all.
Djokovic,
except now they have a tie break
before that. I mean, yeah, Federer balled it. Like, he balled it. He had too much points, you know? It was disappointing. I'm not going to lie to you. But, you know, at least we had that Nadal match, Federer-Nadal on Friday, and indeed Federer-Nadal 2008.
More tennis analysis from Ken during the week, or potentially not. Thanks,
I would say in about 51 and a half weeks' time, we'll be about here.
Thanks, guys. Let's wrap things up.
Thank you. Bye.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.